Part 7 of 9 from set number 3014, The Great Magicians, a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled Jesus the Magician, The Magic of Christ.
We will go on to this evening's topic, which is, as we announced it, the magic of Jesus. It would be very difficult to speak of this subject without mentioning a very important development, the publication of two seminal books, The Secret Gospel and Jesus the Magician by Morton Smith. And so it is somewhat to at least certain aspects of that material that I will initially review for you. In 1958, at the Greek Orthodox Monastery of Mar Saba in the Judean desert, the American scholar Morton Smith, subsequently professor of ancient history at Columbia University, made a very remarkable discovery. In fact, the discovery, the importance and the magnitude of which has not really been appreciated properly to this day. Glued into the cover, I believe, of an old book from the 17th century in the library of that monastery, used as a kind of a stiffener, was a letter written by the hand of Clement of Alexandria, a second century church father, recognized as a father of the church by the Roman Catholic Church and a canonized saint of the Orthodox Church. The letter of Clement spoke very openly of the secret teachings of Jesus, which were reserved for the few. In fact, Clement states there quite explicitly that in his church, the one that he was active in Alexandria, and there were various communities, you know, Christianity was growing at that time, and that in his church there were three levels of instruction in the Christian church. The first level of instruction was given those who were either about to be made to enter the body of the church, neophytes that is, or those who were recently baptized, and to them were given the four canonical gospels which we know of now, Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John. That was their level of instruction. The second level of instruction, which came later, had as its literature, its textbooks, what Clement called secret gospels. These secret gospels were often written by the same evangelists or gospel writers as the canonical ones, but they represented a deeper level of instruction. In fact, he says, and then he illustrates his point, that Saint Mark, the apostle and evangelist, had written two gospels. One that we know as the Gospel of Mark, and the other one, the secret Gospel of Mark. And then, says Clement, concluding this portion of his letter, the third level of instruction consisted of what he calls in these words the hierophantic secrets of Jesus, which cannot be written down. The letter is written to a certain Theodore, obviously an acquaintance of Clement. In the letter, Clement also justifies the existence of secret gospels and secret teachings in general by saying, and I quote, "Not all true things are to be said to all men." And I dare say he includes women also. Which saying itself is a direct quotation offered by Clement from the secret Gospel of Mark. Now, just with this much, the implications of just this amount of information, I think, are momentous. Mainstream Christendom to this day, particularly Protestant Christendom, but since the mighty Church of Rome is becoming more Protestant every day, and might also be included in it, mainstream Christendom prides itself on believing that the teachings of Jesus, and consequently of his church, were always totally open to everybody, that there was no kind of secret or concealed or disguised teaching at all. Now that is completely contradicted by this material. There were not only secret teachings present in the early Christian church, but secret scriptures were present in the early church. And mind you now, I need perhaps to explain a little bit about this really very lovely figure of Clement. I remember years ago in the course of my career as a teacher of religious studies, every other year or so I was wont to offer a course in the early church fathers. And inevitably, when it came to Clement of Alexandria, after a little while, everybody in the class sort of brightened up. His writings, his personality, his approach to things are just so lovely, so learned and at the same time so kindly, so accepting and so Gnostic. He is the most Gnostic of the Orthodox Church Fathers, the second most Gnostic, vying for that position, probably being Origen, whoever was a much more, sort of complex and maybe a tiny bit neurotic personality. What is one to say about somebody who was so troubled by his sexual instincts that he had himself castrated, which is what Origen did? And then, of course, he felt very sorry because nobody would ordain him a priest, because it was already a rule at that time in the church that no castrates could be ordained to the priesthood. Why? You figure it out. I have some ideas, but you figure it out. Nevertheless, it'll be good for you to figure it out. However, Clement wasn't like that at all. Just absolutely a marvelous, lovely man and writer, very poetic, very learned. He studied in the early schools of Alexandria, where the great Neoplatonic teachers and others have taught. He might have been acquainted with Valentinus. Origen definitely was, personally. And truly, his writings are just lovely. So I'm not at all surprised that Clement would have actually admitted to secret teachings and secret practices in the church, and I would have never seen anything wrong with it. So what is very important to remember is that right now, at this point, we are talking about somebody who to this day is accepted by Eastern Christianity and Western Christianity as a very, very important early church father and a great authority on the doctrine of the church. He is the one who said this. So now, however, but there is more. In the letter, used within the context to illustrate the existence and nature of the secret gospels, Clement reproduces a quotation, not very long, from the secret gospel of Mark. The letter states that the evangelist and apostle Mark, after returning from his stay in Italy, in Rome, wrote this gospel for the initiates of the Christian community in Alexandria. Saint Mark, one of the four gospel writers of the canonical gospels, you know, is both the patron saint of Venice and of Alexandria. His symbolic animal, because all the four gospels and their writers have a symbol, is the winged lion, the lion of Saint Mark, which you can see in Venice everywhere reproduced. And it's, of course, in his honor, the great cathedral in Venice, Basilica di San Marco, is named. The Archbishop of Venice, the Roman Catholic Archbishop of Venice, incidentally, is called a patriarch, because he is regarded as a direct successor of an apostle because of the presence of Saint Mark. But Saint Mark is also regarded similarly as the patron saint of Alexandria and of the Coptic Orthodox Church. And His Holiness, the Patriarch and Pope, is also called Pope of Alexandria, on the head of the Coptic Orthodox Church, is also regarded as the successor of Saint Mark. So Mark is quite an interesting figure who had his foot both in the East and in the West, as it were. So, to conclude the story, Morton Smith, after investigating all possible information and conducting tests concerning the authenticity of the letter, including carbon dating and all kinds of complicated computer calculations, which would indicate the similarity or the identity of the text of this letter with the other writings of Clement. You know, that sort of thing can be done. And when all of that checked out, as one might say, colloquially, in 1973, Professor Smith published a book, The Secret Gospel, in which he gave a public and popular account of the discovery. This he did after publishing a scholarly edition of the Greek text and of his commentaries by Harvard University Press entitled Clement of Alexandria and the Secret Gospel of Mark. The passage from the Secret Gospel of Mark, which Clement quotes in the letter, is, as I mentioned, not very long. It contains a brief but uniquely different version of the story of the raising of Lazarus, which is treated in the most complete and, you might almost say, the most romanticized fashion in the 10th chapter of the Gospel of John, but which is also present in the 10th chapter of the canonical Gospel of Mark, not the secret Gospel. Mind you, this is only a portion, a small portion of the secret Gospel of Mark. Clement probably included in the letter because he wanted to show a nice little compact short story from beginning to end, which, although much shorter than in the canonical Gospel, has quite a different content in certain ways, as you will soon see. And incidentally, this is the only portion of the secret Gospel of Mark extant. No more of the secret Gospel has ever been discovered to this day. But you know, if it was there since apostolic times practically, or very soon thereafter, second century and third century, and somebody found it in 1958, well, possibly more shall be found later. In any event, we shall now look at the text, the brief text from the secret Gospel of Mark. Here it is. And they come into Bethany. And a certain woman whose brother had died was there. Very terse compared to, say, the account of the Gospel of John. And a certain woman whose brother had died was there before Jesus and says to him, Son of David, have mercy on me. The woman says this. But the disciples rebuked her. And Jesus, being angered, went off with her into the garden where the tomb was. And straightway a great cry was heard from the tomb. And going near, Jesus rolled away the stone from the door of the tomb. And straightway, going in where the youth was, he stretched forth his hand and raised him, seizing his hand. But the youth, looking upon him, loved him, and began to beseech him that he might be with him. And going out of the tomb, they came into the house of the youth, for he was rich. Then, a curious but most significant cryptic sentence. Only three words. The nocturnal initiation. Period. And then it continues, and thence arising, he returned to the other side of the Jordan. That's it. Now, let us look at some interesting features of this passage. Point one, a woman. In John's Gospel calls her Martha, and even mentions her sister Mary. These are Mary and Martha, the sisters of Lazarus. But neither her name is given, nor the name is given for the dead young man. She comes up to Jesus and says, Son of David, have mercy on me. The disciples rebuke her. And Jesus gets angry, obviously, at the rebukers. and he goes with her to the garden where the tomb is. Previously, of course, it has been stated that this was in Bethany and that the woman's brother had died. Now, in part, motivated by that curious sentence in the middle there, the nocturnal initiation, I have a view of this which differs even slightly from that of Professor Smith, although his conclusions are still very similar to my own. Gnostic terminology, as we know now very clearly from the Nag Hammadi writings, always implies that a resurrection of people is a spiritual resurrection. It runs all through many of the Nag Hammadi scriptures. Therefore, this may be a story of the raising of a spiritually dead person rather than a physically dead person. The woman, I think, utters a ritual phrase asking for a spiritual gift. Have mercy on me, son of David. Son of David, of course, being the addressing Jesus as a prince, a descendant of King David from the royal house. But it's in Greek. That's also a lot of people don't seem to be too much aware of that, how important the Greek language is in all biblical studies. Don't let yourself fooled by these people who are forever prattling about Aramaic. You know, we don't know what language Jesus used when he was speaking. We don't know. What we know is that the first extant copies, the oldest extant copies of the New Testament are in Greek. Not in Hebrew, not in Aramaic, not in Syriac, not in Latin, Greek. And I won't go deeper into this, but this letter by Clement to Theodore also is in Greek. All the cultured people in the Middle East, including in Rome, spoke Greek and wrote Greek. And when they wanted to write in an intellectual manner, then they wrote in Greek. Now, the Greek word for having mercy, eleisonari, is the verb, I believe, from which comes the famous phrase in the Eucharist, Kyrie eleison, Lord, have mercy. However, the meaning of that last word is not necessarily mercy as we understand that. It has multiple and obscure meanings. And one of the meanings is really much more something like, give me your grace. It's not just take pity on me, but rather shed your grace, shed your glory upon me, which is the way that we really utilize it in our rites as well. Therefore, this could very well be a request for something important, for something mysterious. Give me your grace. And the apostles are disturbed by that, and the disciples are disturbed by that. Why? Well, I would say because of jealousy. because a request is made to him for something important, perhaps something so important that they might not even all have received it themselves. And moreover, the one who is asking him is a woman, which is particularly bad. After all, Peter in the Gospel of Thomas says at some point, let Mary go out from among us, because women are not worthy of the life. This is the greater life. So there was a little bit of a man-woman situation in those days also. In any event, previously it has been stated that it was Bethany and that the woman's brother had died or was dead. Now, this needs therefore to be kept in mind that Jesus goes now to where the person about to be initiated is. It's not at all uncommon, even today, I'm not going to name any names, although somebody might recognize it, for in initiatory secret societies, for some initiations to be conferred when the candidate is lying in something that stands for or actually is a tomb or a coffin. And the reason for that being that the person prior to the initiation is considered dead. Neither is it uncommon to this day in certain similar bodies for the initiator to reach into the grave and grab the person by the hand and pull him out or her out of the grave. The term Hiram Abiff comes to mind. That's all I'll say about that. Now, from the tomb, a cry is heard. Now, this is the clearest proof that we are dealing with a physically alive person. It is very unlikely that dead people would be shouting out of a grave. That in itself would be a major miracle, and the miracle hasn't really started yet. If people were routinely shouting from their graves, the cemeteries would be much noisier places than they are, and that much valued eternal rest would be very, very difficult to come by. So I think this is a very important statement. A shout is heard. He shouts out of the grave. And Jesus rolls away the stone from the tomb's entrance, creates an opening. What is the tomb? Well, in all likelihood, it could be, in addition to everything else, if it indeed is not physically symbolized, it might be a metaphor for the body of the individual. Because the body is often referred to, in particularly in Gnostic literature, as a tomb. In any event, what Jesus does is rolls away a stone, removes an obstacle. To what? To the awakening, to what is about to take place. Then he reaches into the tomb and raises the man up while he seizes his hand. I already mentioned something about this. This is, again, quite likely a ritual gesture. The man is now awakened, and he wants to be with Jesus. The likelihood is that he is desirous of more initiation, of more gnosis. They leave the tomb and they go to the man's house where they can be privately. And there comes, of course, now the sentence that I mentioned before, namely the nocturnal initiation. Now, it is quite credible that upon the awakening will follow an initiation. The mysteries, which after all were still quite well known in those days, such as, let's say, the Eleusinian mysteries, usually had two initiations, one minor and one major, the minor being preparatory for the major. And the minor initiation does away with the obstacles that exist within the person. In other words, rolls away the stone. And the obvious response after the first initiation is, I want more. Or as the ritual phrase used again to this day in some places is, I desire, I request more light. And the initiator says, yes, you should have more light. Now comes, of course, the very clear short sentence, the nocturnal initiation. Without this sentence, my whole thesis would be completely conjectural. But this sentence says it very clearly, in initiation and at night. My view is that not only the nocturnal event is an initiation, but the entire story is an initiation. Daytime raising from the tomb is the first initiation, then at night the greater initiation. What any of them consist of, we really don't know. Clement warns in his letter that people should not jump to conclusions as to the nocturnal initiation. He even mentions, and that would be quite understandable within a Greco-Egyptian context, that some kind of a sexual magic might be imagined. In this case, a same-gendered one. Clement indicates that some people have already jumped to this conclusion and that they are wrong. This sort of thing, of course, always happens. Well, not always, but often. When people don't understand something and it seems kind of exciting and mysterious, they say there must be sex in it. That is that way now. That was that way then. Another example of that is the whole business that appears in various Gnostic scriptures, in Gospel of Philip and Pistis Sophia and elsewhere, about Mary Magdalene. It is nowhere stated that Mary Magdalene had any kind of a sexual intimacy with Jesus. What is stated is that she was the most important disciple, and that he confided a great many things to her, did not confide to anyone else, that he conferred initiations on her. But some people, when they read those passages, are immediately convinced that the previously mentioned situation must obtain. And that is sort of because their thinking, I think, is maybe just a little bit too much influenced by their genitalia. This happens. Among some peoples, there are kind of rural sayings, among the Slovaks, for instance, and others, that when somebody thinks in a limited fashion, his brain had slid down to some other part of the body. And we still use the term that somebody thinks with his stomach. Well, there are people who think with their stomach because their mind is always on food. And then there are people who think with something else because their mind very readily gravitates toward sex. Rather correctly, Morton Smith drew the conclusion that Jesus was a magician, to which we may add that he was the great Gnostic magician who initiated or made people enter into the kingdom, as it was called, which the Gnostic calls the fullness or the pleroma. Here are some words of Morton Smith regarding that, which I think are very, very correct. What, speaking of, he writes of Jesus, this is toward the end of the book when he draws his conclusions. What was his special role in relation to the kingdom? This incidentally is from the Secret Gospel, from the book The Secret Gospel. He was the Messiah. So what, says Morton Smith, what was there that he, the Messiah, could do now that he had come, which neither a prophet nor even the Baptist could do, that John? The Gospels give us the answer. His analysis comes from the canonical Gospels, incidentally. I'll mention more about that later. He could admit his followers to the kingdom of God, and he could do it in some special way, so that they were not there merely by anticipation, nor by virtue of belief and obedience, nor by some other figure of speech, but were really actually in, says Morton Smith. This was never claimed for any prophet, not even for the Baptist. But there are lots of statements in the Synoptics, those are the three canonical Gospels minus John, you know, and in all parts of them, from the earliest to the latest, that represent the kingdom as already somehow attainable, and the disciples as already in it. They are the members of a wedding party, who cannot be made to fast, who need not observe the Sabbath nor the purity laws. The law and the prophets were until John, and until his time, and lawyers hindered those who were entering the kingdom. Oh, I would say, now as well as then. You can see that the Gospel and Shakespeare both are very critical of lawyers. But now the kingdom can be taken by violence. The mystery has been given to the disciples. If anyone knocks, it will be opened. Whoever asks, receives. The kingdom is like a field with a hidden treasure. He's, of course, paraphrasing various sentences from the New Testament. a secret pearl that can be purchased now. It is already here, growing like a mustard seed, spreading like leaven through dough. Peter indeed has the keys to the kingdom already while he is here on earth. And all the 12 chosen disciples have power over demons, can heal the sick, and even raise the dead. Whoever hears their master, Jesus. The Father has been revealed to them by the Son. They have seen Jesus in his true glory, have eaten his flesh and drunk his blood. The least of those who is now in the kingdom is greater than the Baptist. The prodigal son has been admitted at once to the feast. This, I think, is a wonderful recension on the part of Morton Smith of at least some of the statements in the New Testament which all prove this point. Smith comes to the conclusion that Jesus conferred a special initiation rite, which Smith says was a baptism. Smith considered this a momentous discovery of his own. I would beg to differ a little bit, because had he read, for instance, the Nag Hammadi scriptures, or even some of the scriptures that were available earlier, such as the two books of Yehu in the Bruce Codex, he would have read there how Jesus administers baptisms of fire, baptism of air on his disciples. So this is nothing new. What Morton Smith discovered and is talking about here was certainly known to the Gnostics, and we have the documentary evidence to that effect. We just a little idea about what this business of baptism of water, baptism of fire, baptism of air, you know, well, earth, water, fire, and air, of course, the old elements, which were used as a kind of a grand metaphor for all kinds of things, because they signify that fourfold structure of the universe, and beyond that, perhaps, of universal being to the ancients, and the fourfold structure makes a complete, a symbol of completeness. So when do you undergo the baptism of earth? Well, I have a feeling that everybody here has undergone it, because that we undergo that when we are born. Plop. You know, here we are on earth and in an earthly vesture. And you know what? We don't like it. Because, at least so I understand, that there is a lot of crying going on among babies. A lot of crying. Right off the bat, as we would say in Transylvania. You know. Go to a maternity ward and the crying is incredible. And I interpret that in part as the wail of the soul. Oh no, not this place again. Oh dear. Oh no. You know. In any event, that's your baptism of earth. Right there. Then eventually we manage to get on our feet and we toddle around as a toddler should, and we sort of move around on the earth. But the time comes to enter the stream. Enter the stream of the mystery. The stream that leads to the great ocean, which is the divine, or nirvana, if you want to use the Buddhist metaphor. And then comes the baptism of water. And this is what, according to the various scriptures, both canonical and Gnostic, John the Baptizer administered, the baptism of water. And, of course, it was also perpetuated. But then there are others. There is fire and there is air. These are the ones that Jesus administers, and these are the deeper mystery. The one that comes after water. You know, again, I don't by any means believe you me that it is the least of my desires is to diminish these incredible mysteries by too much comparison with others. But at the same time, there are certain patterns that exist that run like trajectories across time and across geographical boundaries. And if you look, for instance, at the Hindu Kundalini system, which has these seven centers or chakras, wheels as they are called, what you find there is, and certainly Jung in his famous Kundalini lectures, Joseph Campbell and some others have pointed out that certainly these centers through which this symbolic Kundalini power travels can be regarded as stages of transformation, the stages of initiation, and they start with earth, water, fire, air, ether, or akasha, and nothing. Okay? So it's the same sequence, and it can be found in many other places. So there is a sequence that moves step by step inward, and it's these deeper baptisms, if you want to call them, these deeper initiations, that apparently are the ones biblically and gnostically administered by Jesus. This, incidentally, is my idea, not Morton Smith's. Smith then advances evidence, and a great deal of it at that, that St. Paul the Apostle administered the same kind of baptism that Jesus did. Once again, I'm sure that Smith has read Elaine Pagels's Gnostic Paul, because that should have been published by that time, but there he substantiates the notion that Paul, more perhaps than some of the others, at least in the later period of apostolic history, was the Gnostic. And he was the one who carried the secret tradition. You know, St. Paul had a very bad press for the last 100 years or so. Because people in the 19th century, in the 18th century, sort of began to be courageous enough to voice their disaffection with Christianity the way it has become, and they said it must be somebody's fault that it turned out so bad, you know. And then they picked on Paul. Why? I'm not exactly sure, neither do I think that they were exactly sure. But they said this was a latecomer. He never really was there when Jesus was there. He was sort of an interloper, and then he changed everything around. Fact of the matter is that he was far more mystical, far more Gnostic than Peter, pretty much all the rest of the bunch, with the possible exception of Thomas, for instance, who is really also stands out as a great Gnostic apostle. But certainly someone who apparently definitely had the capacity and also the will to carry on what Morton Smith comes to be called really the secret tradition within Christianity. And there are several of the great Gnostic masters who derive their succession from Paul, one of them being none other than probably the greatest of all the Gnostic teachers, Valentinus of Alexandria. Valentinus, who claimed to have been a disciple of a man named Theudas, who was a direct disciple of St. Paul the Apostle. Now, however, without all of that, I am adding this amplifying material, Morton Smith says that Paul administered the same kinds of mystery initiations that Jesus did, and also that the secret tradition of initiatory Christianity continued. Here is his summary of the main thesis of Jesus as a magician, and also a little bit of an enumeration of the magical features, the magical powers that appear in the New Testament, canonical New Testament, concerning Jesus. And most of the various stories told of him are told of other magicians, he says, and directions for their performance are given in magical papyri. I say some more about it. Among these are, and here he lists a great big litany, I probably won't read all of them, the power to make anyone he wanted follow him, exorcism, even exorcism at a distance, remote control of spirits and the power to order them about, giving his disciples power over demons, miraculous cures of hysterical conditions, including fever, paralysis, hemorrhage, deafness, blindness, loss of speech, raising the dead, stilling storms, walking on water, miraculous provision of food, miraculous escapes, his body could not be seized, making himself invisible, possessing the keys of the kingdom or of the heavens, foreknowledge of his own fate, of disasters coming on cities, knowledge of others' thoughts, introduction of religious reforms and of new magical rites, claiming to be united with others so that he is in them and they in him, claiming to be a god or son of God or united with God, notably in statements beginning I am, claiming to be the only one who knows his God or is known by his God, claiming to be the image of the invisible God. That should be enough for a little litany right there. But then Morton Smith says something very important. To summarize, pagan and Jewish traditions alike represent Jesus as a magician, while Christian tradition represents him as what a successful magician would have claimed to be, the possessor of the Holy Spirit and himself a supernatural being, the Son of God. These reports are confirmed by the many minor magical traits of the miracle stories, and more importantly, by the whole outline of Jesus' career and the essential content of most of the stories about him, which are stories of things magicians claim to do. Further confirmation comes from the history of Jesus' followers, who repeated and improved the legend of his magical powers, continued themselves to practice magic, and were punished for it by the Roman authorities. Of Jesus' many magical actions, the most important was the introduction of the Eucharist, a rite of the well-known magical type by which he sought to unite his followers to himself. Now, baptism is another magical rite intended to unite Jesus' followers to him by making his spirit possess them. It seems to have been practiced in Christianity at the latest within 2 or 3 years of Jesus' death. And there is no strong reason to doubt, and there are some reasons to believe, that it came in already during his lifetime. If we look for the person most likely to have introduced such magical rites for such a purpose, the search will certainly lead us to Jesus himself. Very strongly worded statements, these. Now, what is right and what is wrong in Morton Smith's conclusions? On the whole, his conclusions are right, although in his eagerness to prove his thesis in his second book, Jesus the Magician, which was published in 1978, he shoots past his mark, as it were, by extensively comparing Jesus' actions and words with the magical papyri of Hellenistic Egyptian provenance, and declares that they are the same. Now, the reaction of mainstream Christian folk, even of scholars, to Morton Smith's 2 books was not very favorable. I well remember on one of my earlier visits to the Institute of Antiquity and Christianity in Clermont, you know, where the translations of the Nag Hammadi scriptures were done, and there the subject of Morton Smith came up. And here were these illustrious and learned professors, many of them ordained ministers of various Christian churches. You know, even Dr. Robinson, my favorite, is an ordained Presbyterian minister. But I can say he came a long ways away from John Calvin. And that's a good thing in my estimation, in any event. But you know, here they were, and they had nothing good to say about Morton Smith at all. Oh, he's an atheist. As if 99% of university professors in all fields were not atheists, or at least pretended that they are, because otherwise they would be subject to political incorrectness, you know. And this, that, and the other thing. And he makes up things, he exaggerates things, you know, all kinds of things like that. Really, rather unbecoming things to say about a colleague. The popular press, including Time magazine, insisted on portraying Morton Smith as an offbeat scholar who invented an erotic magician called Jesus. As far as I can determine, he has done nothing of the sort. Regrettably, it seems, Morton Smith was insufficiently informed about Gnosticism and its scriptures. The Nag Hammadi Library was published sometime after his first book and almost simultaneously with his second. To us Gnostics, Professor Morton Smith, I think, however, did a very great favor. And I'll tell you in a minute how he did the favor. But first let me say something not exactly unfavorable, but almost so. Here is the possible mistake on the part of Morton Smith. Yes, there is a tremendous convergence of Greco-Egyptian magic, Hellenistic magic, and the activities and the teachings of Jesus and his apostles. It's absolutely true. However, magic can have more than one objective. And a number of scholars, including Giovanni Filoramo in his book, The History of Gnosticism, a very, very fine book, points out that where there he's writing about the Gnostics, but I think this certainly can be applied to Jesus, that in that very historical period, where just like now, the majority of people interested in magic, in spells, well, other than perhaps the spells of Harry Potter, God bless him, because they are for entertainment, you know. But, you know, in magic, in spells, in conjurations, in, you know, various kinds of rituals, elemental rituals, and so on and so forth, what are their objectives? Their objectives in the vast majority of instances are personalistic objectives. In fact, some of the objectives that I rattled off there that Morton Smith says can also be found in the New Testament. Healings. Look how interested people are in healing, even now. You know, anything is... If this talk were about healing, and I would intimate that maybe somebody might even be healed in consequence, we would have to hold this lecture in the Shrine Auditorium, probably. You know? And so forth. Why? Because all people are sick, very true. I mean, after all, that's what the existentialists found out. Life on earth is sickness unto death. And also, let me tell you something else. Earthly life is the one condition where the prognosis is inevitably fatal. Nobody comes out of it in any other way, at least maybe Elijah did, according to some reports. But, you know, you need a fiery chariot and all of that, and they don't come around very often. You know, a lot of people are sick, they want to get healed. You hurt, you want the hurt to stop. It's understandable. And you'll do anything. You know, you eat horrible, unpalatable health food. You know, you dish out a lot of money for all kinds of practitioners. Anything just to get better. Including, of course, magical things. So, I mean, that's just one. And then love filters, you know. Everybody would like to charm somebody, and some would like to charm more than once, and more than one person. All of these things. And in order to facilitate such ends, magical operations are performed. But then, there comes a point, sort of in the development of the magical soul, and therefore only among few, where what in highfalutin Greek would be called the thaumaturgical objective, namely the miracle-working objective, changes into the objective of redemption, of liberation, of spiritual freedom. But it's still magic. This is the subtle switching of gears, the taking of the great step from the lesser to the greater, from the personalistic to, nowadays, maybe some people would call it the transpersonal, from the, indeed, from the human to the divine. But the magic is still there. And this is what Christendom has forgotten, and that is why magic, even in the Roman Catholic Church, let's say, which to this, I mean, it's really making strides, especially at the local level, to demythologize and to desacralize its own practices, believe you me. But, let's say, certainly prior to the Second Vatican Council and the flapdoodles ensuing therefrom, the Catholic Church was full of magical practices. But even then, except for a few, if you dare suggest to the priest that what they are really doing are magic, they say, no, it's a sacrament. As if there were a difference. But there is a difference if you compare that with somebody trying to hex somebody. There is a difference if you compare that with somebody trying to evoke the spirit of grandma in order to get some information for the latest sale of real estate or purchase of real estate you want to engage in, you know, in the necromantic, spiritualistic fashion. And of course, what always interests me is grandma, dear soul, didn't know a darn thing about real estate when she was alive. You know, but now she is dead, she's supposed to know about real estate. She's not supposed to know about who is going to become president. She's supposed to know whether your wife is able to conceive a child. She never knew any of those things. But, you know, that's how the mind is. Now, these are all low, personalistic, folk magical practices. But the energy behind it or in it, the essential rousing of the powers of the soul of the magician to break through into a different kind of reality and there get hold of these little goodies, is the same as in the greater kind of magic. So I think here is, Morton Smith is quite right. Jesus was a magician, but he wasn't the kind of magician that most of the magicians were with whom Morton Smith compares him, especially in his second book, Jesus the Magician. He is correct in assuming that a certain kind of procedure that he employs is indeed magical. But what is the end? What is the objective? The objective is really only one thing. Gnosis, and by way of gnosis, liberation. Liberation from evil, liberation from unconsciousness, liberation from stupidity, ultimately liberation from physical, the limitations of physical existence itself. That's what it is all about. But the Christians themselves, quite early in the game, not Clement and not the Gnostics, but flapdoodle Christians. There were a lot of them there, there are even more of them now. You know, just a little bit like Morton Smith made the same mistake, only they called them miracles. And so they exalted the physical miracles. Oh, he raised the dead. But when you look at the secret gospel of Mark, did he really? He raised the dead who was hollering out of the grave to begin with and things like that, you know. Oh, he healed this. I had people who were not fundamentalists or even evangelical Christians, maybe not even Christians at all, come seriously up to me and tell me that the one important thing about Jesus is his miracles. Now, if those miracles are the one important thing, then there were a lot of very important things going on with a lot of magicians all over the Middle East, everywhere, at that particular time, because it was a very, very magical period. Just study some of those Greco-Egyptian magical papyri. They're quite interesting, you know. And they're full of words that are a little bit like the Gnostic barbarous words, all made up all out of vowels, and vowel sounds and so forth, and conjurations and divinations looking into a bowl of water, and then the spirits come out and everything. Oh, it's a lot of fun, a barrel of fun. But here is the difference. So really, in their own way, without mentioning the word, the so-called mainstream Christians themselves had fallen into interpreting the transcendental, the liberating magic of this incredible person in a lowly, in a childish, in a primitive way. And the only ones who did not were the Gnostics, because they kept that intentionality. But of course, in the very early days, many others did, semi-Gnostics like Clement and Origen and others also. But this is the great importance between the two kinds of magic. Now, with that, let me go on a little bit. What is the great favor then that Morton Smith has done us Gnostics? First of all, with his discussing of Clement's letter, he proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that esoteric initiatory procedures existed in the early Christian church, replete with secret gospels and all that sort of thing. This recognition shows that the Gnostic position was far closer to the so-called Orthodox one at that time. In fact, and I admit that this is conjectural, I cannot prove this with any kind of definite evidence, I would be very much inclined to think that for about 100 years or so, maybe even more, the normative inner circles of Christendom were all very much oriented to the original magic of its founder, and that they were quite aware that the objective, the mission of the founder of the Christian religion was not to undo the sin of Adam and Eve and all this kind of theological flapdoodle, but to do exactly what Morton Smith mentions in the book, to make an other world, an other kingdom, which ultimately leads to ultimate Godhead and liberation available to people. And that then after the passage of 100 years or so, more and more people were there who temperamentally, and perhaps by way of their IQ, which was not known at that time, couldn't go along with this sort of thing. The natural reaction of a person of limited consciousness, shall we say, let's be very genteel about this now, of limited consciousness, when he's confronted with something that requires a consciousness higher than his, is, it can't exist. Why? Because I can't experience it. It's not true because it ain't happening to me. That's why it's untrue. It never occurs to them that, buddy, it's not happening to you, because you are too dumb, to put it in vulgar terms, or let's say because you are temperamentally and in terms of your spiritual development, well, not quite there yet, my friend, okay? You like that better? Well, there's a polite way of putting it, there's a coarse way of putting it. And these people took over. There were more and more of them. Aren't the unintelligent always in the majority? Well, certainly Henry Gibson thought so when in his famous play, The Enemy of the People, he makes this poor persecuted, he's a doctor, isn't he, the hero, exclaim, "The majority," he says, when somebody tells him, "But the majority wants this or that," he says, "The majority? The majority is never right," he says. Now that puts our political system in a pretty strange situation, But, that's just what happened. The majority were no longer able, because of their consciousness, to participate in these things. And then the majority simply squeezed the minority out and said, "You guys are involved in something that is not right, that is unnecessary, that is elitist, that is pagan. Out with you." And that is, of course, pretty much how they threw the Gnostics out. But initially, I think it was, for the most part, a fairly common, generally available position. I don't mean all the details of Gnostic mythology, such as you find. I don't mean that all of Christendom once believed in everything in the Pistis Sophia or something like that. But the basic thrust, the basic idea, and the initiatory character of the religion, the religion not just by belief, but by experienced redemption, by experienced transformation, was a far more common situation than one would imagine. And in addition to this, I think Morton Smith's elaborately constructed thesis proving that Jesus was a magician also proves many Gnostic teachings. Among these is the importance of sacraments, especially when practiced esoterically. And this, of course, is something that presents difficulties to people from all kinds of positions. The Protestant mind, and after all, you have to remember, this is a Protestant country. By background, it was founded by Puritans. It was led by Enlightenment philosophers who certainly did not share the Puritans' point of view, but the culture itself, And after all, even in the late 19th century, most of the political parties, including the Republican Party of Lincoln, ran primarily on an anti-Catholic platform. And the reformers who were going to clean up the country were going to clean up rum, Romanism, and rebellion. So that, you know, there is this strong Protestant streak that is in the psyche. And the Protestant streak is afraid of sacraments. What's that? Mumbo jumbo that we don't understand, you know. Everybody his own priest. Everybody can make his own Eucharist and so forth. Well, you know, inwardly, inside, purely inside, in a meditative sort of thing, that is true. But it is here that the convergence, the trajectory of the magical, let's say, with the religious, it's very, very important to be able to make that linkage. And let me show you how. I know something about magic at a fairly practical level. I have practiced ceremonial magic. I know the things that can be done. And it's very interesting and sometimes very, very awesome. I'm not talking about theory. But let's say if you are not trained, if your consciousness is not in the right place, and I said you don't have the right training, heaven help you if you try to become your own magician. Heaven help you, especially if you venture into the somewhat more serious practices. If you are trained, if you are reasonably stable, if you know what you are doing, then it's an entirely different matter. In other words, you have to be a magus in order to practice magic. And the great magical orders like Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, around the turn of the, from the 19th to the 20th century, you know, put people through a long period of theoretical and practical training until they achieved the grade of magus, and that's when they were allowed to do magic. You apply this everybody for himself kind of Protestant attitude to magic, you are going to be in deep trouble. The chances are that you'll end up in an insane asylum. And maybe you'll harm even other people and so forth. If religion is magic, then you better not apply that principle, that everybody for himself principle in religion either. Because to say the least, it's not going to work. The sacred technician, the person who inside and outside is prepared and qualified to do certain things within the spiritual magic is important. Now that doesn't mean that you can't get to God in consciousness or otherwise without a priest. But it means that some kind of a qualified and trained and initiated priesthood is very helpful for your own initiation. And whether you come from the Presbyterian Church or whether you come from the Bodhi Tree bookstore, with its new age, this principle still obtains. And you can't just do it because you declare yourself a medium, a yoga teacher, a reverend, a this or that or the other thing. It has to be within a tradition. When you make up your own tradition, your tradition is worth just exactly that. It's been made up. It's been made up of whole cloth. And one of the greatest problems, which I have pointed out many times, is when you create your own reality and you basically make up something, is that you yourself, in some deeper aspect of your mind, will never really trust the situation. Because somewhere deeply within you, there is something that says, you made it up! You made it up! It isn't real! You see? So that is where a valid tradition and valid initiation and valid practice is important. But of course, that shouldn't be made up either. We have people who claim tremendous lineages to, whether it's to the Oglala Sioux tribe and its chiefs, and if they ever met a real Oglala Sioux, they would probably run like nobody's business, you know, or whatever. So you can't make up a lineage either. You can't make up a tradition either. It really has to be there. And that is how magic operates, folks. Whether the magic is called religion, or the magic is called gnosis, or the magic is called anything else. And that is why, I think, that is one of the great reasons why Morton Smith's discovery of this convergence is potentially very, very useful. But the conclusions of it will be resented and have been resented. They have been resented by certain academicians, they have been resented by mainstream Christians, and they would even be resented by New Age type of folk and so forth, because it does not go along with this total autonomy of making up things and calling them real, creating one's own reality, not accepting any kind of lineage, not accept any kind of formally designed and handed down system that so many people have. And for this reason, there are great resistances against this position. But you know, that is probably why the secret gospel of Mark says there, and Clement quotes, that there are true things that should not be told to everybody. Why? Because everybody won't be able to deal with it. So you've got to tell it to those who know how to deal with it and whom it is going to do some good. Oh, but that's elitism. Well, there is elitism and then there is elitism. There is the kind of made-up elitism that has a self-serving purpose, and where some people, usually rather undistinguished people really in every other respect, constitute themselves into a self-made elite and say, we are better than anybody else. But that's false. It's a lie. But on the other hand, every kind of demographic situation will show certain constellations of stratification. There are those who are this level, that level, and on other level, and then those who are the top of the pyramid. And it's true of consciousness. Jung, the great psychologist, very clearly pointed out that at any given time there are only very, very few people around in the world who really can be called conscious. Then there are a little more who are aspiring to consciousness, and then there is a vast majority who doesn't know what consciousness is. They wouldn't know if it stared them in the face and stepped on their toes, and they are pursuing entirely different things. So here too, there is a justification, therefore, for these higher teachings concerning initiatory and similar elements to be made available perhaps to those who are ready for them rather than otherwise. So the sacramental and initiatory element has been powerfully brought to our attention by Morton Smith. Another is the continued presence of a secret initiatory tradition in early and later Christianity. Morton Smith definitely states in these two books that the magic that Jesus started went on, that it largely went through St. Paul, and that it went on, and apparently the secret, the initiatory procedures, in a secret way, of course, as the very name declares, continued, and after a fashion have always been in the world. In certain historical periods, a low kind of orthodoxy mitigated against them, then a rationalism mitigated against them, and that is still to a very large extent true today, but that they were still there. This also is very, very important and very true, because this in turn, in many ways, is our hope. Because if these mysteries continued, then they are capable of being experienced today. Now you might say, but I don't need a continuation, you know. Mother, I want to do it myself. As years ago there was a stupid thing on television like that. Now there are probably very few people remember. It isn't really worth remembering that much. But I remember a lot of things that are not worth remembering. That's the trouble with me, you know. Maybe with some of you too. Now, all right. Yes? There are, at any given time in history, a few people, even if they are bereft of everybody else and out somewhere totally by themselves, without any books and without any access to traditions and information, will somehow bulldoze their way through the barriers and somehow roll away the stone. This has to be admitted. This is possible. But it's hard. It's difficult. Very few people can do it. And it's somewhat like saying that every time I want to drink water and I'm in somewhere, I'm going to dig my own well. I'm going to drill for water. I'm not going to take advantage of the sources that are already here because somebody else dug the well. It's not a very reasonable proposition, and the chances are that you're going to die of thirst if you pursue it far enough. So therefore, I think it's a very wonderful thing that there possibly is that ongoing stream, that ongoing tradition of gnosis, which Morton Smith really indicates, and a magical gnosis, a sacramental gnosis as that. Morton Smith has shown us the figure of Jesus as a hierophant of mysteries, a practitioner and initiator into rites of sacred magic. He has shown us that many early Christians, even highly influential ones like Clement, were not adverse to viewing Jesus, the founder of their faith, of their tradition, in that light. And so, I'm sorry to say that and to reaffirm that, but it's important. The commonly accepted Jesus of faith, a miracle worker without magic, a celebrant of Last Suppers without mystery, a mere enunciator of teachings without sacrament, is not the founder of Christianity as these people in the early times really knew him. The Protestant Reformation made a mistake, but it, at least on the part of Luther, who was quite an integritous man, the mistake was, I think, honest and understandable. Christianity has degenerated a lot by that time. The magical practices have become very, very low and very superstitious folk magical practices. It all became very trivial. And so people like Luther and Erasmus and so forth looked at it and said, this doesn't seem right. We just can't believe that Jesus started this kind of thing. We can't believe that these things go back to him. Therefore, what we've got to do is do away with this stuff. And then maybe we'll work our way back to the original, the pure Christianity. So they did away with a lot of things over a period of time. But what they came up with was not the original, was not the pure Christianity. Now they had pretty much nothing. They had endless sermons by puffed-up preachers who knew often less about the spiritual life than the people they were preaching at, and this is still true. They substituted the pulpit for the altar, and the pulpit became an even bigger disappointment than the altar had been before in the darkest Middle Ages. And what remained was nothing. The only thing that could come out of that now was rationalism and eventually atheism and, I don't know, chaos theory and the sort of things that are going on now. So that's kind of where the mistake was made. It didn't occur to the reformers that these things which have become such primitive and superstitious practices originated in something transcendental. That before people allowed them to fall back down to this purely thaumaturgical, personalistic level, their intent really was liberating the soul from all things on earth. And that therefore, that the systems of the Catholic Church, let's say, or of the Orthodox churches, are very much like the thread of Ariadne that we hear about in classical mythology. You've gotten into the labyrinth and you can't find your way back. If the thread is there, you can find your way back to the source. And so even a mixed up and corrupted sacramentalism like an Ariadne's thread, ultimately leads back to something tremendously valuable. And at the very end, at the very foundation, it leads back to the founder, the originator, the Hierophant, the raiser of the spiritually dead, and Jesus the magician. But when those things that Jesus the magician has bequeathed are lost sight of, corrupted, trivialized, then there is nothing. Oh, but we have the Bible, the Word of God, you know. Yes, we have Babel. We have the Tower of Babel. We have the Tower of Babel. Words. We have bibliolatry, the worship of a book. A book which is dead without the practice. And somehow we think, and that can be any kind of book. A book is a book is a book. Even if I write it, it's still a book. And there are a lot better ones. The truth is not in words. The words perhaps can stimulate, can lead a little bit in that direction. Like the Zen Buddhists say, a finger pointing to the moon. But magic is not a finger pointing to the moon. Magic takes you to the moon, or brings the moon down. You know, the witches have old practices. They saw, what's it called? That's how much I know about witchcraft and Wicca. I think it's chanting down the moon or something of that sort, bringing the moon down, you know. Because they show a way of rolling the stone away and bringing the two together. That which is on the other side, the spiritual side, the mystery, the marvel, the glory, with all of its fantastic excitement, its real life, and the other, which is where we are, which is pretty much dead. A body that is dying as soon as it is born, thoughts that for the most part are not worth thinking, feelings that constantly lead us into trouble. I mean, what kind of life is this? What kind of a mess? What kind of absurdity? The existentialists were right. You know, it's an absurd and a sick situation. But it doesn't have to remain that way. You have to break through a certain barrier. You have to roll away a certain stone. And then everything is different. Why? Because it's magic. And the implementation of that, the experience of that, even the moving toward the experience, the first initiation and the others, these are up to you. My job is only really at this point here now, a finger pointing to the moon. But I hope that I have pointed with some resoluteness and with some precision. And if I have, then I'll be happy. And thank you very much.
Copyright MMR by BC Recordings. Catalog number 341407. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org. That's gnosis.org.